This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Elizabeth Colbert, a staff writer at The New Yorker and author of the book Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change. Elizabeth Colbert is here today to tell us about her most recent book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History, published in 2014. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Thanks for having me.
What led you to write your book, The Sixth Extinction?
It really started with the previous book, which, as you mentioned, was a book about climate change. And I started writing that about a decade ago. And climate change is a huge story. I guess I, on some level, thought there couldn't be a bigger story. And I went looking for another story to write on that basic issue. So another book to write. And then as I was doing reporting around, I came to this rather amazing realization that climate change was really only part of an even bigger story. And that even bigger story is all the ways that people are changing the planet on what really amounts to a geological scale. So these changes will be permanently inscribed in Earth history. And the sort of unifying theme of all these changes is extinction. The ways, you know, when you change the planet faster than organisms can adapt and evolve, a lot of them drop out. That's what we learned from the fossil record. So that became my new book.
What led to the concept of extinction? What is the history?
It has a really interesting history, and to appreciate how interesting it is, you really have to go back a step, basically to the late 1700s, when there was no concept of extinction. It was just assumed that if a species was around, if an animal or a plant was around, it had been around forever, and it was going to be around forever, and that was because the Creator had put it there, and, you know, why would you create something that wasn't going to hang around? And that was the prevailing thought at the end of the 18th century, when a guy in post-revolutionary Paris, a naturalist named Georges Cuvier, came along. And at this point, you were starting to get very interesting fossils from around the world as the Europeans went around the world and you know, plundered it, basically, and colonized it. And there were a lot in Paris, a lot of mammoth bones, mastodon bones. And he looked at them and said, well, if these animals were out there, we would have seen them by now. And he just made this sort of fundamental shift and said, if we're not finding them, that's because they're not out there. It was a pretty simple move, but he was the first to really make it, and he went so far as to postulate a whole lost world. He decided there had been a whole world that had been lost, and he actually succeeded in really proving that, too. He had correspondents all over Europe who sent him pictures of their fossils, and he named a lot of the animals that we know today as fossil animals. For example, he gave the pterodactyl its name, based on a picture that someone had sent him of a fossil that had been found in Germany, for example.
What is the background extinction rate?
That varies from sort of one class of organisms to another. People have done a lot of work on that. What you have to do to try to calculate that, and it's obviously a very rough calculation as you go through these huge databases of fossils. But for mammals, then the more or less recent geological past, it's been calculated that a mammal should go extinct, let's say, very roughly, I'm speaking in very rough terms, a species of mammal should go extinct maybe once every 700 years.
If there's a mass extinction event, then what does the extinction rate look like?
Oh, right. Well, during mass extinctions, I mean, mass extinctions are, in fact, defined as times when the extinction rate spikes up very dramatically. And right now, you will see estimates that extinction rates are hundreds of times, perhaps thousands of times, perhaps for some groups, tens of thousands of times above background rates. And in terms of mammals, you know, just to take that as one example, we are now seeing mammals go extinct on the order of, let's say, once a decade.
Would you give an overview of the great extinctions that have taken place in the past?
Well, there have been five what are called major mass extinctions. It's a little bit of an oxymoron, but you can also have a minor mass extinction. The five major ones are sometimes called the Big Five. And the first of these took place about 450 million years ago. at the end of what was known as the Ordovician period. And what's interesting about that is that most of life at that point was still aquatic. You just didn't find anything on the land. The very first plants were colonizing the land, but most everything lived in the sea at that point. And something like 80% of all marine species died out at that moment. And then the worst of all mass extinctions was the third of these. It's called the end Permian extinction. It happened about 250 million years ago, and something like 90% of all species on the planet died out. And then the most recent of the big five was the end Cretaceous extinction, which occurred about 66 million years ago. That is familiar to everyone as the extinction that wiped out the dinosaurs. And there's a pretty broad scientific consensus at this point that that was caused by an asteroid impact. So you will often hear scientists now that we are at the beginning, or hard to say exactly where we are in this process, but of the sixth extinction, you will hear people say, and I have heard scientists say, we are the asteroid, people are the asteroid.
So you mentioned the asteroid that was the cause of one of the major extinctions in the past. What were the causes for the other extinctions?
In the case of that very first one that I mentioned, the Ordovician, which is, you know, a long time ago, I have to say that, you know, you have to think of this as really of detective work. You know, if you think of a cold case, you know, this is a 450-million-year-old cold case. So to do the kind of detective work, the CSI work for that, is really complicated. But right now, I think the prevailing theory for that is that it was caused actually by a very sudden glaciation. It's a cold snap that occurred at that point. So that's the theory for that one. For the third one, the biggest one, which is sometimes called the mother of all mass extinctions, the theory there is that it was caused by this massive volcanic activity, a sort of huge burst of volcanic activity. And that's a very sobering thought, because what that did was release massive amounts of CO2. And we are now releasing massive amounts of CO2. So the parallels there are frightening.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Elizabeth Colbert, author of the book The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. You've referred to this a bit already, but what is the evidence that a sixth great extinction is currently taking place?
One thing just to say on a very basic level is that we shouldn't see, I mean, if you say, well, let's say a mammal should go extinct on the order of once every 700 years, and for other groups of organisms, it should be even less frequent. So we shouldn't see anything. In the course of a human lifetime, for all intents and purposes, you know, you should not be able to say an organism went extinct. You should not be able to see that. Now, we are seeing organisms go extinct all the time. I myself have seen organisms that are now extinct. And any conservation biologist out in the field is watching species go extinct. So if that's happening, you know something quite extraordinary is going on. Now, does it rise, you know, to the level of the end Cretaceous extinction? Certainly it doesn't at this point. It's very, very trivial compared to that. But if you look at the number and proportion of species that we know about that are endangered, and you look, people have done very careful studies, you know, how fast are they moving through the various stages of being threatened and endangered and critically endangered, and they've actually tried to compare that to what we think must have happened during the mass extinctions of the past, and they've concluded that what's happening has the potential to be on the order of those other extinctions.
Again, you've referred a bit to this, but why has it been proposed that our current era be called the Anthropocene?
There are a lot of different ways that you can skin that cat. The Anthropocene is the name that's been given by people who have proposed that we've entered a new geological epoch. Technically, we live in the Holocene, which is the time since the end of the last glaciation, which is about 12,000 years, ended about 12,000 years ago, and there are a lot of different ways people have proposed that you could say, well, we're in a new geological time period. And when geologists look at this as a really technical question, they say, okay, what is going to be preserved of what we've done to the planet? Everything that we think of as very important, our cities, our homes, our literature, our music, all that's going to be gone. What's going to be left as a marker, you know, in the earth? So that if you were a geologist 100 million years from now, you could come back and say something happened here. And what they look at are things like, for example, carbon emissions. That will be all the fossil fuels that we're burning, the CO2 we're putting up into the air. That will leave behind a marker, a very distinctive marker. The way that we've transformed, for example, the bottom of the sea, we trawl across the bottom of the sea. That leaves a distinctive marker. You'll be able to see that, you know, potentially quite a long time from now, how we've changed the bottom of the sea. The pollen record will change. For example, when you take a forest and you turn it into a monoculture farm, you leave behind a very different pollen record. Pollen is incredibly durable. It will still be around many millions of years from now, traces of it. Our nuclear tests, for example, will leave a very interesting geochemical marker. So that's what geologists look at when they say, have we entered, you know, a new time period? Will we leave behind markers that will be here basically forever? And part of that is this extinction event. We will see that many creatures went extinct at this, what will look like a single moment in time.
Why is the rate of change in environment that humans are causing a particular problem?
Rate really gets to the heart of the issue because, you know, extinction in the normal course of things is happening, let's just say, roughly at the same rate evolution is taking place. And if that were the case, right, then you would have speciation and extinction roughly balancing out, and the diversity of the world would remain roughly constant. If you speed up the rate of extinction, then obviously the diversity of the world is going to drop. And in terms of what we're doing, in terms of changing the world very quickly, we are changing the world so quickly that many organisms can't evolve and adapt to the change fast enough. That's at least the theory, and we certainly seem to be seeing that out there in the world right now. So rate turns out to be very, very significant. You know, there have been people who say, well, the climate's changed in the past, for example, and that's absolutely true, but it tended over geological time to take a really long time for the same sorts of changes that we are producing now in a matter of, say, decades or maybe centuries. You know, maybe in the past they took hundreds of thousands, millions of years. So rate is very significant to organisms that either have to migrate or evolve to try to keep up with that.
What is known about the ability of species to move geographically to adapt to climate change? What does the research you speak about in your book show?
Yeah, well, in the book I go to the Andes with a guy who's watching how trees are moving up slope in the Andes, very high Andes. And, you know, obviously trees can't move, but they can send out seeds that will seed themselves. And now they're seeding themselves at higher and higher elevations, right? So we can watch species that used to be at one elevation. Now we can find them higher and higher up the mountain. And that study and others like it have shown that species move at very different rates. So some of these trees are, like, metaphorically speaking, racing up the mountain, and some of them are just sitting there. And what we can infer from that is that these forest communities are going to be very, very radically different. They're already different from what they were, you know, just 20 years ago, and they're going to keep changing. And how all of the animals that then depend on those different species, how they're going to adjust, how fast they can move, these are questions that are really hard to answer because you have to have very, very extensive studies. People are trying to answer them, but we don't really have the answer yet.
Would you speak about the disappearance of amphibians that is currently going on?
Yeah, that it's called the amphibian crisis, and for good reason. Amphibians are probably the most endangered class of organisms out there right now. Something like 40% of all amphibians are classified as endangered that we know about, you know, that we have enough information about. And one of the big factors in this amphibian die-off has been a fungal disease that somehow got spread around the world, presumably by people moving things around the world, but no one knows exactly how. But it has affected amphibians even in very, very remote places because it can travel along in the water. So I went to a place in Panama, for example, central Panama, which used to have a lot of really just fantastically beautiful frogs, including something called the Panamanian golden frog, which is this taxi cab yellow frog, a very lovely frog. They used to be all over. People would tell you, you would go out, you know, you'd step on them practically along certain streams. And then this fungus came through and people sort of could watch it come through, and it just wiped out everything, and now that frog, the Panamanian golden frog, for example, is extinct in the wild. There's still some in zoos, but it's extinct in the wild.
What are the thoughts about why the fungus is spreading now as opposed to some point in the past?
Well, the theory, and it's turned out to have a lot of very complicated genetics. People look at the fungus and they're trying to trace it back to some sort of ore fungus somewhere, and they've had trouble doing that. But the theory is at some point in the pretty recent past, people moved amphibians around, and one candidate that's often mentioned is this frog called the African clawed frog, which was used in pregnancy tests, believe it or not, because if you basically injected it with the urine of someone who was pregnant, the frog would lay eggs. And before we had sort of very sophisticated pregnancy tests that you could, you know, just go to the drugstore and buy, obstetricians would keep, and people of a certain age can tell you, you know, they remember this, these frogs in their office, and they were moved all around the world from Africa. And one theory is that they took this fungus around the world, but no one is sure about that.
Overall, how large a threat are invasive species to biodiversity, and how are humans causing the spread of these?
Well, invasive species turn out to be a really, really serious threat, and they are implicated in many of the known extinctions that have occurred to date. And if you include in that introduced pathogens, right, like this fungal disease that's killing off amphibians, the number grows. So people, when you think about it, it's really, really hard in a pre-human era, right? It's very, very hard for a land organism to cross an ocean, and it's very, very hard for a marine organism to get from one ocean to another. But what we do routinely every single day is move hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of species around the world. And when you bring together these evolutionary lineages that have been separated for a long time, very weird things can happen, and sometimes they can cause massive, massive mortality. So, for example, the chestnut blight that really wiped out the chestnut tree, the American chestnut, which was the dominant tree in the part of the world that I live in New England, over a course of a couple of decades, it just basically got wiped out. That was once again because we brought trees in from Asia that carried disease that the chestnuts in this country couldn't deal with. So that's an example of just a very, very fast way that an introduced or invasive species can just wipe out another species. You see this many, many times on islands. You bring in predators, and island species tend to not have very many predators. They don't have the behaviors to defend themselves. And so, for example, many island birds have been wiped out that way by bringing in rats and foxes. I mean, the list goes on and on.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Elizabeth Colbert, author of the book The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. You also spend time in your book talking about the effect of carbon dioxide on the oceans and the effect on biodiversity that comes from that. Would you say a few words on that topic?
This is a phenomenon that's often called global warming's equally evil twin, and it refers to the fact that a lot of the carbon dioxide that we're putting into the air is being absorbed by the oceans. That's just a natural exchange of gases between the atmosphere and the oceans. So whatever we put up there, about a third of it is pretty quickly ending up in the oceans. And when CO2 dissolves in water, it forms an acid. It's a very weak acid, but it's an acid. And you put enough in there and you change the chemistry of the oceans. If that's what we're doing, that's very well documented. It's very clear. And by changing the marine chemistry, you know, it changes a lot of aspects of marine life. And it particularly, it seems to make life difficult for creatures that build shells or exoskeletons out of calcium carbonate. So that's a lot of creatures that we'd recognize. That's oysters, that's mussels, that's corals. Coral reef building corals. And one of the really interesting things I did for the book is I went to a part of the Bay of Naples that has this CO2 coming up actually out of the bottom of the sea through these volcanic vents. And so it's creating this sort of naturally acidified water. And scientists have seized on that as a way to look into the future. If we continue to pump CO2 into the air and so effectively into the ocean, then the ocean is going to eventually reach the same chemistry of this part of the Bay of Naples. And when you go there and go snorkeling, as I did, you can see that away from these vents, you know, you see a lot of coral, you see a lot of sea urchins, you see a lot of barnacles, you see a lot of creatures with shells, and then when you get up near these vents, it's just sort of this moonscape. There's very, very little that can survive there. So that's a way of trying to look at what the impacts of what we're doing are, and that I found very, very dramatic.
To what extent have humans caused extinction historically, before the present day?
Well, the evidence seems to suggest that we've been at this project actually for quite a while. When our very distant ancestors got to Australia, when they got to North America, when they got to South America, you see coincident with people arriving within the next, you know, few thousand years, a lot of the large animals disappear. And there's been this sort of raging debate for quite a long time. People realized this and said it was kind of weird going all the way back to Darwin's day. And there's been this sort of raging debate about why this is the case. And increasingly, it seems pretty clear that it was people. People probably mostly hunting, but perhaps also changing the landscape in various ways, and that these very large and slow to reproduce animals just couldn't keep up. And that's why we don't have mastodons on this continent anymore. We don't have mammoths. There are a lot of big animals, big cats, giant sloths. We had all these things that were in North America before people got here. They're just not here anymore.
What have been some of the efforts to prevent extinction?
Well, there are massive efforts to prevent extinction, and I guess you could say they come in two varieties, and one is a variety of focusing species by species. So we have the Endangered Species Act, for example, and when we identify a species that's on the verge of extinction, we, you know, go in, and a lot of protections do kick in at that point, and there have been really heroic efforts to try to save species. The American condor, for example, is a multi-million dollar project to try to save this bird, the largest land bird in North America, of which there were only 22 left at one point. Now we're back up to a couple hundred, but it's been a very, very fraught effort. So that's one sort of effort to protect species. And then there are broader efforts, you know, to preserve big tracts of habitat and hope that the species in there will do okay. You see a lot of, you know, obviously on some level all of our national parks, our national wildernesses are all sort of aimed at that. So those are just some of the efforts that people are making to try to stave off extinction.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
I really hope my book will change the way people look at the world. I guess that's an immodest hope, but I guess that is my hope. I really hope that people will start to put things together and understand how we are changing the world and how what we're doing, even just by doing these things that we consider to be really, really ordinary, really turn out to be, for example, you know, driving our kids to school, that turns out to be a really unusual thing to happen in terms of the whole history of the planet. So a lot of times people say, you know, that the history of science has tended to humble people. So, you know, first we had to deal with the fact that the sun doesn't revolve around the earth, the earth revolves around the sun. Then we had to deal with the fact that, you know, with Darwin, that we are really just another species like any other species that descended from ancient forebears. And so all that does is sort of tended to put people in their place, which is certainly true. But I think what I would like people to realize is actually that people are, do turn out to be rather extraordinary, and we're extraordinary in the way that we really dominate the planet at this point, and it's really under our control, as it were, even if we're not quite sure what we're doing, and that we really need to face up to that and take responsibility for that.
Why do you think humans have survived, but not Neanderthals or other human-like species?
It's an unanswered question, unanswerable on some level, since we weren't there. But I think that a lot of the qualities that turn out to make humans so successful, the fact that we're very smart and we're capable of forming very, very sophisticated social groups, that we pass knowledge on, that we have these amazing, this amazing technical knowledge, technology that has grown and grown through the ages and been passed down from generation to generation. These give us advantages over, you know, all of our competitors, and the Neanderthals were one of our competitors. And whether we killed them off or whether we just outcompeted them is hard to say. Now, one of the interesting things about the Neanderthals, who are our, very, very close relatives, is that we turn out to have had sex with them before we killed them off. That is being revealed by genetic studies, and that's in the book. And so many of us, most of us, really all people who are not descended from Africans, carry a little bit of the Neanderthal genome around in them.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I guess the message that I'd like to leave people with is that we live in an extraordinary moment in time in which we really are deciding, without meaning to, what's going to happen to pretty much everything else on the planet, and that I think people really need to think about that pretty deeply.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Elizabeth.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You were just listening to Elizabeth Colbert, author of the book The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History, published in 2014 by Henry Holt and Company. For more information, check on the web at elizabethcolbert.com. Again, that's Elizabeth, K-O-L-B-E-R-T.com. Elizabeth Colbert will speak about her book, The Sixth Extinction, at Town Hall Seattle on Friday, February 21st from 7:30 to 9 p.m. Again, that's Town Hall Seattle, Friday, February 21st from 7:30 to 9 p.m. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM and kexp.org.